Red Storm Rising by Tom Clancy. Copyright 1986 by Jack Ryan Enterprises Limited and Larry Bond. All rights reserved. This book consists of 652 pages divided into 43 chapters. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. Tom Clancy's first novel was the phenomenal The Hunt for Red October, a story about the chase for a defecting Soviet submarine that topped the bestseller lists for 7 months, that had the intelligence experts of several nations reading it for its astonishing authenticity, that gained raves from critics, admirals, and even the president himself. "If Red October is only Clancy's first," wrote Jack Higgins, "then the rest of us better look out, because God alone knows what the second and third are going to be like." Red Storm Rising is Clancy's second novel, and it is in every way bigger, more daring, even more thrillingly dramatic. Once again, the players are the U.S. and the USSR, but this time the stakes are much higher. When Muslim fundamentalists blow up a key Soviet oil complex, making an already critical oil shortage calamitous, the Soviets decide they have no choice. To survive, they must seize the oil in the Persian Gulf. To seize the oil, they must find a way to keep NATO from retaliating. And they find it. Red Storm, an audacious 4-month master plan of elaborate diplomatic trickery and crash military buildup designed to keep the West off balance and ready it for the knockout blow. As the weeks tick by and we watch the brilliant Soviet strategy unfolding, the rumors flying, the West scrambling to keep up, Clancy turns up the tension, notch by notch, until it seems it can go no higher. And then the novel explodes with the full fury of the Soviet armed forces as they sweep into Europe and the North Atlantic, and the West finds itself in an all-out shooting war, and maybe more. The climactic battle for control of the globe. In one of the most remarkable depictions of modern warfare ever written, Clancy weaves men, planes, ships, missiles, and submarines. Scenes of large-scale battle and individual acts of heroism. Moments of tragedy, joy, and unimaginable endurance into an intricate pattern that dances and whirls before our eyes. Filled with a memorable cast of Russians and Americans alike, and the extraordinary authentic detail for which Tom Clancy has been acclaimed, it is both a triumph of the storyteller's art and frighteningly real. He has had a private talk with the President of the United States, who proclaimed himself an avid fan. He has lunched with the White House staff. He has lectured at the Central Intelligence Agency. Yet Tom Clancy is neither a former intelligence officer nor naval officer. Rather, he is an insurance broker from a small town in Maryland whose only previously published writing was a letter to the editor and a 3-page article about the MX missile. Extensive research about Soviet-American naval strategies and submarine technology gave him the background for The Hunt for Red October. For Red Storm Rising, his research included sailing for a week aboard a frigate, witnessing live fire exercises, descending into a submarine, consulting with a high-placed Soviet defector to discuss how war plans would be presented to the Politburo, and interviewing military and intelligence personnel of all ranks. He is now at work on his third novel. Author's note. This book began some time ago. I got to know Larry Bond through an advertisement in the U.S. Naval Institute Proceedings when I purchased his war game, Harpoon. It turned out to be amazingly useful and served as a primary source for The Hunt for Red October. I was intrigued enough about it that I drove to a wargamers convention that summer, 1982, to meet him in person, and we ended up becoming close friends. In 1983, while Red October was in pre-production, Larry and I started talking about one of his projects, Convoy 84. A macro war game or campaign game which, using the harpoon system, would fight out a new battle of the North Atlantic. I thought this was fascinating, and we began talking about building a book around the idea, since, we both agreed, no one outside the Defense Department had ever examined in adequate detail what such a campaign would be like with modern weapons. The more we talked, the better the idea got. Soon we were fiddling with an outline and trying to find a way to limit the scenario to a manageable scope, but to do so without removing any essential elements from the stage. This proved to be a problem without a really adequate solution, despite endless discussion and not a few violent disagreements. Although Larry's name does not appear on the title page, this book is his as much as mine. We never did figure out the division of labor, but what Larry and I accomplished was to complete a book as co-authors when our only contract was a handshake, and have a whole lot of fun doing it. It is for the reader to decide how successful we have been. Acknowledgements. It is impossible for Larry and me to thank all those who assisted us in so many ways in the preparation of this book. Were we to try, we would leave out the names of people whose contributions were more than merely important. To all those who gave freely of their time, answering endless questions, then explaining their answers at length, we know who you are and what you did. All of you are in this book. Particular thanks, however, are due to the captain, officers, and the men of FFG 26, who, for one marvelous week, showed an ignorant landlubber something of what it means to be a sailor. Preliminary quotation. From time immemorial, the purpose of a navy has been to influence and sometimes decide issues on land. This was so with the Greeks of antiquity, the Romans, who created a navy to defeat Carthage, the Spanish, whose armada tried and failed to conquer England, and, most eminently, in the Atlantic and Pacific during two world wars. The sea has always given man inexpensive transport and ease of communication over long distances. It has also provided concealment, because being over the horizon meant being out of sight and effectively beyond reach. The sea has supplied mobility, capability, and support throughout Western history, and those failing in the sea power test, notably Alexander, Napoleon, and Hitler, also failed the longevity one. Edward L. Beach in Keepers of the Sea. Chapter 1. The Slow Fuse. Nizhnyavartovsk, RSFSR. They moved swiftly, silently, with purpose, under a crystalline, star-filled night in western Siberia. They were Muslims, though one could scarcely have known it from their speech, which was Russian, though inflected with the sing-song Azerbaijani accent that wrongly struck the senior members of the engineering staff as entertaining. The three of them had just completed a complex task in the truck and train yards, the opening of hundreds of loading valves. Ibrahim Tolkaze was their leader, though he was not in front. Rasul was in front, the massive former sergeant in the MVD who had already killed 6 men this cold night, 3 with a pistol hidden under his coat and 3 with his hands alone. No one had heard them. An oil refinery is a noisy place. The bodies were left in shadows, and the 3 men entered Tolkaz's car for the next part of their task. Central Control was a modern 3-story building fittingly in the center of the complex. For at least 5 kilometers in all directions stretched the cracking towers, storage tanks, catalytic chambers, and above all the thousands of kilometers of large-diameter pipe which made Nizhnyavartovsk one of the world's largest refining complexes. The sky was lit at uneven intervals by waste gas fires, and the air was foul with the stink of petroleum distillates, aviation kerosene, gasoline, diesel fuel, benzene, nitrogen tetroxide for intercontinental missiles, lubricating oils of various grades, and complex petrochemicals identified only by their alphanumeric prefixes. They approached the brick-walled, windowless building in Tolkaz's personal Jiguli, and the engineer pulled into his reserved parking place, then walked alone to the door as his comrades crouched in the back seat. Inside the glass door, Ibrahim greeted the security guard, who smiled back, his hand outstretched for Tolkaz's security pass. The need for security here was quite real, but since it dated back over 40 years, no one took it more seriously than any of the pro forma bureaucratic complexities in the Soviet Union. The guard had been drinking, the only form of solace in this harsh, cold land. His eyes were not focusing, and his smile was too fixed. Tolkaza fumbled, handing over his pass, and the guard lurched down to retrieve it. He never came back up. Tolkaza's pistol was the last thing the man felt, a cold circle at the base of his skull, and he died without knowing why, or even how. Ibrahim went behind the guard's desk to get the weapon the man had been only too happy to display for the engineers he'd protected. He lifted the body and moved it awkwardly to leave it slumped at the desk, just another swing shift worker asleep at his post, then waved his comrades into the building. Rasul and Mohammed raced to the door. "It is time, my brothers." Tolkaza handed the AK-47 rifle and ammo belt to his taller friend. Rasul hefted the weapon briefly, checking to see that a round was chambered and the safety off. Then he slung the ammunition belt over his shoulder and snapped the bayonet in place before speaking for the first time that night. "Paradise awaits." Tolkaza composed himself, smoothed his hair, straightened his tie, and clipped the security pass to his white laboratory coat before leading his comrades up the 6 flights of stairs. Ordinary procedure dictated that to enter the master control room, one first had to be recognized by one of the operations staffers. And so it happened. Nikolai Barsov seemed surprised when he saw Tolkaza through the door's tiny window. "You're not on duty tonight, Isha." "One of my valves went bad this afternoon, and I forgot to check the repair status before I went off duty. You know the one, the auxiliary feed valve on kerosene number 8. If it's still down tomorrow, we'll have to reroute, and you know what that means." Barsov grunted agreement. "True enough, Isha." The middle-aged engineer thought Tolkaza liked the semi-Russian diminutive. He was badly mistaken. "Stand back while I open this damned hatch." The heavy steel door swung outward. Barsov hadn't been able to see Rasul and Mohammed before, and scarcely had time now. 3 7.62-millimeter rounds from the Kalashnikov exploded into his chest. The master control room contained a duty watch crew of 20, and looked much like the control center for a railroad or power plant. The high walls were cross-hatched with pipeline schematics, dotted with hundreds of lights to indicate which control valve was doing what. That was only the main display. Individual segments of the system were broken off onto separate status boards, mainly controlled by computer, but constantly monitored by half the duty engineers. The staff could not fail to note the sound of the 3 shots. But none of them were armed. With elegant patience, Rasul began to work his way across the room, using his Kalashnikov expertly and firing 1 round into each watch engineer. At first, they tried to run away, until they realized that Rasul was herding them into a corner like cattle, killing as he moved. 2 men bravely got on their command phones to summon a fast response team of KGB security troops. Rasul shot one of them at his post, but the other ducked around the line of command consoles to evade the gunfire and bolted for the door where Tolkaza stood. It was Boris, Tolkaza saw, the party favorite, head of the local collective, the man who had befriended him, making him the special pet native of the Russian engineers. Ibrahim could remember every time this godless pig had patronized him, the savage foreigner imported to amuse his Russian masters. Tolkaza raised his pistol. "Isha!" the man screamed in terror and shock. Tolkaza shot him in the mouth and hoped Boris didn't die too quickly to hear the contempt in his voice. "Infidel." He was pleased that Rasul had not killed this one. His quiet friend could have all the rest. The other engineers screamed through cups, chairs, manuals. There was nowhere left to run, no way around the swarthy, towering killer. Some held up their hands in useless supplication. Some even prayed aloud, but not to Allah, which might have saved them. The noise diminished as Rasul strode up to the bloody corner. He smiled as he shot the very last, knowing that this sweating infidel pig would serve him in paradise. He reloaded his rifle, then went back through the control room. He prodded each body with his bayonet, and again shot the four that showed some small sign of life. His face bore a grim, content expression. At least 25 atheist pigs dead. 25 foreign invaders who would no longer stand between his people and their god. Truly, he had done Allah's work. The third man, Mohammed, was already at his own work as Rasul took his station at the top of the staircase. Working in the back of the room, he switched the room system's control mode from computer automatic to emergency manual, bypassing all of the automated safety systems. A methodical man, Ibrahim had planned and memorized every detail of his task over a period of months, but still he had a checklist in his pocket. He unfolded it now and set it next to his hand on the master supervisory control board. Tolkaza looked around at the status displays to orient himself, then paused. From his back pocket, he took his most treasured personal possession, half of his grandfather's Koran, and opened it to a random page. It was a passage in the chapter of the spoils. His grandfather, having been killed during the futile rebellions against Moscow, his father shamed by helpless subservience to the infidel state, Tolkaza had been seduced by Russian schoolteachers into joining their godless system. Others had trained him as an oil field engineer to work at the state's most valuable facility in Azerbaijan. Only then had the god of his fathers saved him, through the words of an uncle, an unregistered imam, who had remained faithful to Allah and safeguarded this tattered fragment of the Koran that had accompanied one of Allah's own warriors. Tolkaza read the passage under his hand. "And when the misbelievers plotted to keep thee prisoner, or kill thee, or drive thee forth, they plotted well. But God plotted too, and God is the best of plotters." Tolkaza smiled, certain that it was the final sign in a plan being executed by hands greater than his own. Serene and confident, he began to fulfill his destiny. First, the gasoline. He closed 16 control valves, the nearest of them 3 kilometers away, and opened 10, which rerouted 80 million liters of gasoline to gush out from a bank of truck-loading valves. The gasoline did not ignite at once. The three had left no pyrotechnic devices to explode this first of many disasters. Tolkaza reasoned that if he were truly doing the work of Allah, then his God would surely provide. And so he did. A small truck driving through the loading yard took a turn too fast, skidded on the splashing fuel, and slid broadside into a utility pole. It only took one spark, and already more fuel was spilling out into the train yards. With the master pipeline switches, Tolkaza had a special plan. He rapidly typed in a computer command, thanking Allah that Rasul was so skillful and had not damaged anything important with his rifle. The main pipeline from the nearby production field was 2 meters across, with many branch lines running to all of the production wells. The oil traveling in those pipes had its own mass and its own momentum supplied by pumping stations in the fields. Ibrahim's commands rapidly opened and closed valves. The pipeline ruptured in a dozen places, and the computer commands left the pumps on. The escaping light crude flowed across the production field, where only one more spark was needed to spread a holocaust before the winter wind, and another break occurred where the oil and gas pipelines crossed together over the River Ob. "The Greenskins are here," Rasool shouted a moment before the quick response team of KGB border guards stormed up the staircase. A short burst from the Kalashnikov killed the first two, and the rest of the squad stopped cold behind a turn in the staircase as their young sergeant wondered what the hell they had walked into. Already, automatic alarms were erupting around him in the control room. The master status board showed four growing fires whose borders were defined by blinking red lights. Tolkaza walked to the master computer and ripped out the tape spool that contained the digital control codes. The spares were in the vault downstairs, and the only men within 10 kilometers who knew its combination were in this room. Dead. Mohammed was busily ripping out every telephone in the room. The whole building shook with the explosion of a gasoline storage tank 2 kilometers away. The crashing sound of a hand grenade announced another move by the KGB troops. Rasool returned fire, and the screams of dying men nearly equaled the ear-splitting fire alarm klaxons. Tolkaza hurried over to the corner. The floor there was slick with blood. He opened the door to the electrical fuse box, flipped the main circuit breaker, then fired his pistol into the box. Whoever tried to set things aright would also have to work in the dark. He was done. Ibrahim saw that his massive friend had been mortally hit in the chest by grenade fragments. He was wobbling, struggling to stay erect at the door, guarding his comrades to the last. "I take refuge in the Lord of the Worlds," Tolkaza called out defiantly to the security troops, who spoke not a word of Arabic. "The King of Men, the God of Men, from the evil of the Whispering Devil." The KGB sergeant leaped around the lower landing, and his first burst tore the rifle from Rasool's bloodless hands. 2 hand grenades arched through the air as the sergeant disappeared back around the corner. There was no place and no reason to run. Mohammed and Ibrahim stood immobile in the doorway as the grenades bounced and skittered across the tiled floor. Around them the whole world seemed to be catching fire, and because of them the whole world really would. Allahu Akbar! Sunnyvale, California. "God almighty," the chief master sergeant breathed. The fire, which had begun in the gasoline diesel section of the refinery, had been sufficient to alert a strategic early warning satellite in geosynchronous orbit 24,000 miles above the Indian Ocean. The signal was downlinked to a top-security U.S. Air Force post. The senior watch officer in the satellite control facility was an Air Force colonel. He turned to his senior technician. "Map it."
"Yes, sir."
The sergeant typed a command into his console, which told the satellite cameras to alter their sensitivity. With the flaring on the screen reduced, the satellite rapidly pinpointed the source of the thermal energy. A computer-controlled map on the screen adjacent to the visual display gave them an exact location reference.
"Sir, that's an oil refinery fire. Geez, and it looks like a real pisser. Colonel, we got a big bird pass in 20 minutes, and the course track is within 120 kilometers.
"Uh-huh," the colonel nodded. He watched the screen closely to make sure that the heat source was not moving, his right hand lifting the gold phone to NORAD headquarters, Cheyenne Mountain, Colorado. "This is Argus Control. I have flash traffic for Sync NORAD."
"Wait one," said the first voice.
"This is Sync NORAD," said the second, Commander-in-Chief of the North American Aerospace Defense Command.
"Sir, this is Colonel Burnett at Argus Control. We show a massive thermal energy reading at coordinate 60 degrees 50 minutes north, 76 degrees 40 minutes east. The site is listed as a POL refinery. The thermal source is not, repeat, not moving. We have a KH-11 pass close to the source in 20 minutes. My preliminary evaluation, General, is that we have a major oil field fire here."
"They're not doing a laser flash on your bird?" Sync NORAD asked.
There was always a possibility the Soviets were trying to play games with their satellite.
Negative. The light source covers infrared and all of the visible spectrum. Not, repeat, not monochromatic.
We'll know more in a few minutes, sir. So far, everything is consistent with a massive ground fire.
30 minutes later, they were sure. The KH-11 reconnaissance satellite came over the horizon close enough for all of its 8 television cameras to catalog the chaos. A side link transmitted the signal to a geosynchronous communications satellite, and Burnett was able to watch it all in real time, live and in color. The fire had already engulfed half of the refinery complex and more than half of the nearby production field, with more burning crude oil spreading from the ruptured pipeline onto the River Ob. They were able to watch the fire spread, the flames carried rapidly before a 40-knot surface wind. Smoke obscured much of the area on visible light, but infrared sensors penetrated it to show many heat sources that could only be vast pools of oil products burning intensely on the ground. Burnett's sergeant was from East Texas and had worked as a boy in the oil field. He keyed up daylight photographs of the site and compared them with the adjacent visual display to determine what parts of the refinery had already ignited.
"God damn, Colonel!"
The sergeant shook his head reverently. He spoke with quiet expertise.
"The refinery? Well, it's gone, sir. That for POL production while they rebuild that from scratch. And once they get those field fires put out, they'll have to rearrange their gas and diesel production quite a bit. I'll say one thing for Ivan. When he has an industrial accident, he doesn't screw around. A major inconvenience for our Russian friends, Sergeant."
This analysis was confirmed the next day by the CIA, and the day after that by the British and French security services. They were all wrong. Chapter 2. Odd Man In. Date time, 0131, 0615, copy 1 of 1 Soviet Fire BC, Soviet Fire BJT 1809 FL. Disastrous fire reported in Soviet Nizhnevartovsk oil field, FL. EDS moved in advance for Wednesday PMS FL by William Blake FC, AP military intelligence writer. Washington, AP. The most serious oil field fire since the Mexico City disaster of 1984 or even the Texas City fire of 1947 sundered the darkness in the central region of the Soviet Union today, according to military and intelligence sources in Washington. The fire was detected by American National Technical Means, a term that generally denotes reconnaissance satellites operated by the Central Intelligence Agency. CIA sources declined comment on the incident. Sources in the Pentagon confirmed this report, noting that the energy given off by the fire was sufficient to cause a brief stir in the North American Aerospace Defense Command, which was concerned that the fire was a possible missile launch directed at the United States, or an attempt to blind American early warning satellites with a laser or other ground-based device. At no time, the source pointed out, was there any thought of increasing American alert levels or of bringing American nuclear forces to higher states of readiness. It was all over in less than 30 minutes, the source said. No confirmation was received from the Russian news agency TASS, but the Soviets rarely publish reports of such incidents. The fact that American officials referred to 2 epic industrial accidents is an indication that many fatalities might result from this major fire. Defense sources were unwilling to speculate on the possibility of civilian casualties. The city of Nizhnevartovsk is bordered by the petroleum complex. The Nizhnevartovsk oil production field accounts for roughly 31.3% of total Soviet crude oil, according to the American Petroleum Institute, and the adjacent newly built Nizhnevartovsk refinery for approximately 17.3% of petroleum distillate production. Fortunately for them, Donald Evans, a spokesman for the institute, explained, oil underground is pretty hard to burn, and you can expect the fire to burn itself out in a few days. The refinery, however, depending on how much of it was involved, could be a major expense. When they go, they usually go pretty big, Evans said. But the Russians have sufficient excess refining capacity to take up the slack, especially with all the work they've been doing at their Moscow complex. Evans was unable to speculate on the cause of the fire, saying the climate could have something to do with it. We had a few problems in the Alaskan fields that took some careful work to solve. Beyond that, any refinery is a potential Disneyland for fire, and there simply is no substitute for intelligent, careful, well-trained crews to run them. This is the latest in a series of setbacks to the Soviet oil industry. It was admitted only last fall at the plenum of the Communist Party Central Committee that production goals in both the eastern Siberian fields had not entirely fulfilled earlier hopes. This seemingly mild statement is being seen in Western circles as a stinging indictment of the policies of now-departed Petroleum Industry Minister Zatijan, since replaced by Mikhail Sergeyev, former chief of the Leningrad Party apparatus, regarded as a rising star in the Soviet Party. A technocrat with a background of engineering and party work, Sergeyev's task of reorganizing the Soviet oil industry is seen as a task that could last years. APBA 0131 0501 ESTFL, end of story. Moscow, RSFSR. Mikhail Eduardovich Sergeyev never had a chance to read the wire service report. Summoned from his official dacha in the birch forests surrounding Moscow, he'd flown at once to Nizhnevartovsk and stayed for only 10 hours before being recalled to make his report in Moscow. 3 months on the job, he thought, sitting in the empty forward cabin of the IL-86 airliner, and this has to happen. His two principal deputies, a pair of skilled young engineers, had been left behind and were trying even now to make sense of the chaos, to save what could be saved, as he reviewed his notes for the Politburo meeting later in the day. 300 men were known to have died fighting the fire, and, miraculously, fewer than 200 citizens in the city of Nizhnevartovsk. That was unfortunate, but not a matter of great significance, except insofar as those trained men killed would eventually have to be replaced by other trained men drawn from the staffs of other large refineries. The refinery was almost totally destroyed. Reconstruction would take a minimum of 2 to 3 years and would account for a sizable percentage of national steel pipe production, plus all the other specialty items unique to a facility of this type. 15,000 million rubles. And how much of the special equipment would have to be purchased from foreign sources? How much precious hard currency and gold would be wasted? And that was the good news. The bad news, the fire that had engulfed the production field had totally destroyed the well tops. Time to replace, at least 36 months. 36 months, Sergeyev reflected bleakly. If we can divert the drill rigs and crews to redrill every damned well and at the same time rebuild the EOR systems. For a minimum of 18 months, the Soviet Union will have an enormous shortfall in oil production. Probably more like 30 months. What will happen to our economy? He pulled a pad of lined paper from his briefcase and began to make some calculations. It was a 3-hour flight, and Sergeyev did not notice it was over until the pilot came back to announce they had landed. He looked with squinted eyes at the snow-covered landscape of Vnukovo II, the VIP-only airport outside of Moscow, and walked alone down the boarding stairs to a waiting ZIL limousine. The car sped off at once, without stopping at any of the security checkpoints. The shivering militia officers snapped to attention as the ZIL passed, then returned to the business of keeping warm in the sub-zero temperatures. The sun was bright, the sky clear but for some thin high clouds. Sergeyev looked vacantly out the windows, his mind mulling over figures he had already rechecked a half dozen times. The Politburo was waiting for him, his KGB driver told him. Sergeyev had been a candidate or non-voting member of the Politburo for just 6 months, which meant that, along with his 8 other junior colleagues, he advised the 13 men who alone made the decisions that mattered in the Soviet Union. His portfolio was energy production and distribution. He had held that post since September, and was only beginning to establish his plan for a total reorganization of the 7 regional and all-union ministries that handled energy functions, and, predictably, spent most of their time battling one another, into a full department that reported directly to the Politburo and Party Secretariat, instead of having to work through the Council of Ministers bureaucracy. He briefly closed his eyes to thank God. There might be one, he reasoned, that his first recommendation, delivered only a month earlier, had concerned security and political reliability in many of the fields. He had specifically recommended further Russification of the largely foreign workforce. For this reason, he did not fear for his own career, which up to now had been an uninterrupted success story. He shrugged. The task he was about to face would decide his future in any case, and perhaps his country's. The ZIL proceeded down Leningradsky Prospect, which turned into Gorkovo, the limousine speeding through the center lane that policemen kept clear of traffic for the exclusive use of the Vlasti. They motored past the Intourist Hotel into Red Square and finally approached the Kremlin Gate. Here the driver did stop for the security checks, 3 of them, conducted by KGB troops and soldiers of the Taman Guards. 5 minutes later, the limousine pulled to the door of the Council of Ministers building, the sole modern structure in the fortress. The guards here knew Sergeyev by sight and saluted crisply as they held open the door so that his exposure to the freezing temperatures would last but a brief span of seconds. The Politburo had been holding its meetings in this 4th-floor room for only a month while their usual quarters in the old Arsenal building were undergoing a belated renovation. The older men grumbled at the loss of the old Tsarist comforts, but Sergeyev preferred the modernity. About time, he thought, that the men of the party surrounded themselves with the works of socialism instead of the moldy trappings of the Romanovs. The room was deathly quiet as he entered. Had this been in the arsenal, the 54-year-old technocrat reflected, the atmosphere would have been altogether like a funeral, and there had been all too many of those. Slowly, the party was running out of the old men who had survived Stalin's terror, and the current crop of members, all young men in their 50s or early 60s, was finally being heard. The guard was being changed. Too slowly, too damned slowly, for Sergeyev and his generation of party leaders, despite the new general secretary. The man was already a grandfather. It sometimes seemed to Sergeyev that by the time these old men were gone, he'd be one himself. But looking around this room now, he felt young enough. "Good day, comrades," Sergeyev said, handing his coat to an aide, who withdrew at once, closing the doors behind him. The other men moved at once to their seats. Sergeyev took his halfway down the right side. The party general secretary brought the meeting to order. His voice was controlled and businesslike. "Comrade Sergeyev, you may begin your report. First, we wish to hear your explanation of exactly what happened." "Comrades, at approximately 2300 hours yesterday, Moscow time, 3 armed men entered the central control complex of the Nizhnevartovsk oil complex and committed a highly sophisticated act of sabotage." "Who were they?" the defense minister asked sharply. "We only have identification for 2 of them. One of the bandits was a staff electrician. The third," Sergeyev pulled the ID card from his pocket and tossed it on the table, "was senior engineer I.M. Tolkaze. He evidently used his expert knowledge of the control systems to initiate a massive fire which spread rapidly before high winds. A security team of 10 KGB border guards responded at once to the alarm. The one traitor, still unidentified, killed or wounded 5 of these with a rifle taken from the building guard, who was also shot. I must say, having interviewed the KGB sergeant, the lieutenant was killed leading his men, that the border guards responded quickly and well. They killed the traitors within minutes, but were unable to prevent the complete destruction of the facility, both the refinery and production field.
"And if the guards responded so fast, how then did they fail to prevent this act?" the defense minister demanded angrily.
He examined the photographic pass with palpable hatred in his eyes.
"What was this black-ass Muslim doing there in the first place?"
"Comrade, work in the Siberian fields is arduous, and we have had serious difficulties in filling the posts we have there. My predecessor decided to conscript experienced oil field workers from the Baku region to Siberia. This was madness. You will recall that my first recommendation last year was to change this policy."
"We have noted it, Mikhail Eduardovich," the chairman said. "Go on."
"The guard post records all telephone and radio traffic. The response team was moving in under 2 minutes. Unfortunately, the guard post is located adjacent to the original control building. The current building was constructed 3 kilometers away when new computerized control equipment was obtained from the West 2 years ago. A new guard post was also supposed to have been built, and the proper materials were allocated for this purpose. It would appear that these building materials were misappropriated by the complex director and local party secretary for the purpose of building dachas on the river a few kilometers away. Both of these men have been arrested by my order for crimes against the state," Sergeyev reported matter-of-factly. There was no reaction around the table. By unspoken consensus, those 2 men were sentenced to death. The formalities would be worked out by the proper ministries. Sergeyev continued, "I have already ordered greatly increased security at all petroleum sites. Also on my orders, the families of the 2 known traitors have been arrested at their homes outside Baku and are being rigorously interrogated by state security, along with all who knew and worked with them. Before the border guards were able to kill the traitors, they were able to sabotage the oil field control systems in such a way as to create a massive conflagration. They were also able to wreck the control equipment so that even if the guard troops had been able to get a crew of engineers in to restore control, it is unlikely that anything would have been saved. The KGB troops were forced to evacuate the building, which was later consumed by the fire. There was nothing more they could have done.